Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Contemporary Issues in Child Protection seminar series organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 7th of June 2011. Bryony Beresford, working with parental mental health problems.
What happened was, in I think it was about 2006, SCI, Social Care Institute for Excellence, which is the kind of social care equivalent of NICE, which is the sort of medication drug centre for excellence, commissioned us to do a review of evidence around the prevalence of mental health problems among parents and what evidence is there around what works in terms of supporting parents and children where a parent has a mental health problem. And what are the barriers to families accessing support? So they gave us sort of three questions, really, to sort of look at the evidence on. So about numbers, about detecting. Is anybody out there using some system to sort of routinely screen the people who come through their doors? How does this work? Is it effective? What evidence is there around parents and children's views about accessing services and the acceptability of those services? What are their experiences as service users of services which are there to support them as parents with a mental health problem or the wider family? And what do we know about whether or not these sorts of services and interventions that are being delivered to parents and or their children, do they work? So evidence on effectiveness. Quite a lot, really, to ask out of one review, and that's what, in a sense, why I've ended up completing four separate pieces of work. What you do when you're doing a review like this is you use very broad search terms to sort of which you sort of put in through search engines to identify any published research, and you come up with thousands of possible or potentially useful articles and studies, which you then whittle down to a smaller number of papers which are of sufficient quality for you to kind of trust the evidence and are relevant to the questions you have. So it's quite a sort of slow progress. So in the end, you might just end up, I think, certainly with that final question we had about effectiveness, what outcomes do interventions achieve, what do we know about effectiveness? I think we ended up working with only about 24 studies there. And there wasn't a very big evidence base, to be honest, across any of these. It's quite a neglected area in research. And I think it's quite neglected also in terms of routine data collection by the sort of big population studies that governments do as well. So quite a weak evidence base. That's kind of how one goes about this sort of review. But just to say that Guy asked us not to look at postnatal depression. That was felt to be a separate issue. Been quite a lot of work around that already. That's kind of one group where there tends to be sort of more robust evidence and work. A previous review had looked at that. And also not to look at parent or mental health issues where there was a dual diagnosis. So mental health plus substance abuse was also, they didn't want us to look at that. So I'm just going to really take you through each of these questions and sort of feedback to you the sorts of the findings and what we were able to glean from the evidence. At the moment, population studies are not very good at asking people, population studies of kind of mental health aren't good at asking whether or not an adult has children. So we had to kind of do a bit of deducting really here. So if we've had to use sort of, in a sense, made some assumptions here. So if you look at a population of non-elderly adults at any given time, around 9 to 10% of women and 5 to 6% of men, we think will be parents. That's at any time, and of those people with a mental health problem, most will have what we call the common mental disorders such as depression or anxiety. Much less frequently occurring are sort of psychotic and serious mental illnesses. A very 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 small proportion actually have those sorts of issues. So the sort of biggest group that you would be encountering will be those softer, more common mental disorders, which sometimes don't even carry that label mental illness. They would just be sort of seen as a mental health problem. But given the nature of mental health problems in that they can fluctuate, people can, in a sense, recover to some extent and then perhaps relapse back, over the lifetime of being a parent, obviously a greater proportion of parents will have had or will be experiencing a mental health problem. So we looked at what the data could tell us about who was at higher risk of mental health problems among parents. And the evidence certainly would suggest that women are at greater risk of developing a mental health problem when they are a parent compared to men. We looked at sort of marital status, whether or not parents were lone parents or in a relationship. And what the evidence does show is that both lone mothers and lone fathers, so in a sense the gender thing sort of washes out here, are both more likely to have a mental health problem compared to mothers or fathers living in couples. So there's something, some sort of protection going on there perhaps around being in a couple, or it could be that mental health problems in a sense might cause a relationship to break down. What we don't know is what's happening in terms of cause and effect here. We've just got, in a sense, the sort of picture. And certainly the increased risk for mental health problems among lone parents is around the more those common mental disorders as opposed to the sort of psychotic illnesses. But what happens is when you factor in socioeconomic disadvantage, the sort of lone parent being a risk factor washes out. And so what we think is happening here, it's more about your socioeconomic disadvantage just increasing your risk for mental health problems than your lone parent's status. Because lone parents tend to be poorer, that's so it's in a bit of a it's a bit of a sort of a misleading conclusion to draw that it's lone parenthood that's causing or is associated with mental health problems. It actually seems to be actually more about socioeconomic disadvantage. There's also some evidence that it's younger mothers are more likely to develop a mental health problem or have a mental health problem compared to older mothers. And so that's kind of all quite robust evidence from the big sort of population studies that, that all governments will be carrying out. And similarly, this the data I'm presenting here. If you look at adults with psychotic conditions, so the sort of psychiatric type survey work that goes on, compared to the whole population of adults with psychotic conditions, actually you're less likely to have parents in that group compared to the whole population. So there's a lower incidence of parents with psychotic conditions compared to the whole population of non-elderly adults. But almost one in five adults with psychotic conditions were in a couple with children. That's how they are defined. Whether or not they're actually parents isn't a question. That's the sort of question that's asked. And 7% of adults with psychotic conditions are identified as being lone parents. There's no robust evidence about is prevalence of mental health problems greater or less among black and minority ethnic groups, or whether or not certain ethnic groups are at greater risks. I think the only data that, only sort of message we can draw from the data really is that there is likely to be, you know, that we can't just lump BME together. You've got to look at within the different communities, and that nobody's done that, and there aren't sufficient numbers to really look at that at the moment. Apart from these kind of rather tentative findings, and which are hard, I think, perhaps to sort of explain, there is some evidence that lone mothers from BME communities may be a little bit more likely to be depressed than white mums, but less likely to have anxiety-related problems, but I would treat those quite tentatively. Just going back to that sort of interesting issue about disadvantaged parenthood and mental health problems. So what's happening here? What's causing what? And essentially, we don't really know. But I think it just reiterates the importance of when you're working with families, where there's disadvantage, where there's mental health problems, and whether or not they're in a sort of lone parent status. In a sense, these things seem to be interlocking, and you need to be sort of aware of all the issues when you're working with these sorts of adults. And it's only something I'll come back to later when we talk about parents' views about the acceptability of the help they're receiving and whether or not they feel it's meeting their needs. So it's worth just bearing that in mind. So about the numbers of children with a parent with a mental health problem. Again, because psychiatric surveys, whole population psychiatric surveys, don't tend to ask whether or not these adults have children. It's quite a limited evidence base. But what there is would suggest that for children aged 5 to 15, one in four will have mothers who would be classed at risk for a mental health problem. That might be they currently have a mental health problem, they've had one in the past. So that equates to, in a primary school class, assuming your primary school class is about the same size as those in England, about 6 to 7 children. It's quite a lot, isn't it, in a class? And where you've got schools with a higher proportion of lone parents, that proportion is going to be higher. Looking at it sort of from a slightly different direction, looking at people using adult mental health services, how many of those are parents? Again, we struggle here because adult mental health services aren't good at asking whether or not they're used as a parent. Certainly don't ask it routinely. But the estimate is about a quarter of adult psychiatric hospital settings are parents. And that's a significant user group. And as I'll report later, their parenthood and the fact they have children who might want to visit, isn't really being addressed at the moment. In acute and community mental health services, as I mentioned, parenting data isn't being routinely recorded. So we're not really sure, certainly in community mental health services, we don't know how many adult mental health service users are parents. Okay, so the second question that Sky asked us to look at was around detection. Are there any sort of good sort of screening instruments out there that are being used, that are being shown to reliably pick up parents who are in need help around mental health issues? And, you know, what are the consequences of using those sort of screening tools in practice? Does it mean that there's a sort of change in the sort of journey or the support parents take? And I suppose this really is kind of looking at, whereas with postnatal depression, something is routinely administered to mothers around 6 to 12 weeks after the birth of their child to try and pick it up. It's like, well, is anything similar happening generally? What we know is, in terms of, it's kind of a constant thing that came out of this, was the fact that adult mental health don't routinely kind of look at parenting status. But it would seem intuitively that primary health care, the place where kind of the first port of call in terms of health care, would be a natural setting for where parental mental health problems could be kind of picked up, screened for and picked up in a similar way, postnatal depression. So it seems to be a sort of potential place to do it. And also, maybe there's a need for professionals who work with children, that's maybe child and adolescent mental health services, children and family services, perhaps even schools. Maybe they need to get better at somehow being better identifying, detecting and responding to parental mental health issues. There's quite a lot of research around, well, what are the barriers to professionals sort of picking up or noticing that an adult they're working with has a mental health problem and that they're also a parent? There's certainly issues around perceived competence, whether or not they have the sort of skills and knowledge to kind of make those sorts of judgments. So professionals working in children's services or professionals working in adult services but not in mental health express a kind of lack of expertise about knowing when something that's being presented to them by one of their users actually is a mental health problem that requires some sort of action. And they're equally, when you're looking at professionals who work with adults in mental health settings, they are likely to have a sort of expertise and awareness of the issues that might be in terms of the children of that adult. Adult mental health tends to take a very much an individual approach to treating the adult, as opposed to a sort of taking a sort of family context. It's a very different approach to CAMHS. And if you perceive your role as an adult mental health professional, if you perceive your role as that, it's very hard to sort of break out of that and look wider. Those working in primary care, so they simply haven't got the time in a sort of an appointment with a woman or a man, or even if they identify them as a sort of mother or a father, to sort of explore softer signs of sort of mental distress. There's also the fact that parents may not want to be identified themselves or be detected. Lots of concerns, I'm sure you're aware of those or come across this, about the consequences of revealing you've got a mental health concern or problem, the sort of whole feeling that it will set in chain, sort of child protection processes. And parents, if you look at the sort of qualitative research, researchers interview parents, they sort of, this notion of it's a very high risk thing to do. And even when parents are aware they are needing help, it's still a huge, huge barrier, this sort of concern about the consequences of letting on that you need help. And there is something around parents not feeling that anybody could help anyway, and what could they do? But in a sense, to sort of counter that, a trusted relationship can help to overcome those sort of concerns. So in the US, they have started using some very simple screening tools in primary care and other settings, and they found that they're quite feasible to use, they're quite acceptable to parents. And what tends to happen is, if they are used and the screening tool indicates a concern around mental health, it does prompt the professional to either in their own, within their sort of field, their own expertise, to sort of start doing something or to refer the parent on. I mean, it's pointless if these tools are just being used and flagging up an issue and nothing happens. But what the evidence is that if you use these tools, either professional, in a sense, includes in their work with that parent issues around mental health, and or they see the need to refer on. But what these projects in the US did find is that you might well refer parents on, but there still is this problem about parents taking up that referral, that offer of support. But at least it kind of progresses it one step further than it just being undetected. So there's, it doesn't, it's not a solution, but it's sort of a way forward to sort of improving the situation, certainly which might exist in this country. Okay, our third question that Sky asked us to look at was about parents' experiences of accessing or their views about, in a sense, taking up offers of help or taking up a referral for support for themselves or for their child. So looking at access and then also looking at acceptability. So once they are service users, is it something that they continue to engage with? I mean, are they kind of those issues around retention, keeping to appointments, those sorts of issues? Is it a sort of acceptable to them, what's being offered in terms of the help they're being offered? Is it something they find acceptable and appropriate and helpful? So this was very much studies which had done sort of interviewing work as opposed to some of the other questions we had. We were looking at number data. This was very much about looking at where studies have sort of interviewed both parents, very little work with children on this issue, about their needs or their views about their parents or their parents' experience of accessing support. Not always very good quality research, so we have to be quite tentative about the conclusions we draw. And interestingly, we didn't find a single piece of research which had looked at fathers' experiences of accessing support for their mental health problems within the context of them being a parent as well. So we have to be tentative, even though there's quite a lot of evidence. So this slide really sort of encapsulates all the sorts of barriers or facilitators to accessing services, because often what can help a parent access a service, the flip side is if it's not there, it's a barrier. So that's why we've kind of linked them together. So socio-demographic factors, looking at the individual factors first, certainly it seems that younger mothers are more likely to be able to sort of be offered help, and also women as opposed to men. So we've got the sort of age and gender issues, and that's really something to sort of, and as alert really for services in terms of making sure that professionals aren't just holding stereotypical views about parental mental health problems and who might have them. Race and ethnicity, not a lot of work in this area, but it would appear to be that particularly for Asian parents, there is a reluctance to engage with services which are staffed by people who aren't Asian. But you can overcome that by, in a sense, having an Asian worker kind of linking you into a sort of more generic service. But that's really as far as we've kind of got on that. I think often an assumption is made that ethnicity is a barrier to accessing generic services. And I'm not sure about that, really. I think it's maybe a bit of a sort of, it's sort of a myth that perpetuates itself. I'll give you an example from a project I'm working on in a sort of different area. We've been looking at parenting support groups for parents of disabled children. And they tend to be like 6 to 8 week courses, a bit like a sort of Triple P or Incredible Years type thing, but tailored around parents who've got a child with autism, that sort of thing. And in one of our research sites over in Manchester, where this group intervention is delivered across the whole city, they deliberately choose not to run, you know, cultural, ethnic groups, specific groups. Parents are encouraged just to come to mixed groups. And when we've interviewed the parents from Asian families, Polish families, about their views about being in this kind of mixed ethnic group, they say they prefer that. Because the thing that is the common denominator for all of them is their child and the problems their child has, as opposed to their ethnicity or their culture. And actually they positively welcome the chance to be in sort of this inclusive group, because it helps them in terms of wider inclusion and exposure to different ideas and views. So that's just an example from a different area which kind of, in a sense, in that context, for that parenting support service, the sort of going down as sort of keeping ethnic groups separate wasn't seen as necessary and certainly is an acceptable approach. Lots of things around knowledge and belief, the parents' knowledge and beliefs, which might be a barrier to them accessing services. Quite a few studies have said that when they talk to parents about why they think they're depressed, why they think they're anxious, typically what's coming out of those studies is parents ascribe the reasons for that to external causes. So they'll say, it's because I've got no money. It's because I've been in an abusive relationship. It's because my child's behaviour is just out of control. And they see that as the cause of their mental health problem. And therefore they see, those are the things that I need help with, not how I'm feeling about myself or my mental health. And unless they're being offered services that are going to tackle those things, they don't see the reason to take up support. Lots of things around beliefs about help seeking, which I think sort of ties into this sort of fear of being known to be sort of struggling either with mental health problems and or managing their child, not wanting to be seen as a failure. And certainly within a sort of subgroup of parents who have mental health problems, there is a group of parents who want to be seen as capable and coping and reluctant to ask for help. Got a lot of experience around that with parents of disabled children who just feel that that's, in a sense, how they want to sort of present themselves to professionals. I'm sure that's going to be some within the sort of group of parents, more generally with parental mental health problems, who will have that sort of feeling about themselves. They don't know what sort of help's available. If they think what they need help with is around managing their child's behaviour, if they don't know that's out there, then they're not going to sort of, or what's on offer, then obviously accessing service is going to be a barrier. Once again, there's issues around straight away it's going to be about losing custody. That's kind of the sort of jump they make. And the sort of stigma associated with having a sort of mental health label, both in terms of all the professionals, not just the one mental health professional who's working with them, but all the other professionals will know I've got this label. But also within their communities, within their families, if they're getting help, mental health support, there's that sort of stigma there. Parents also talk about the fact that their sort of general life circumstances are a barrier to them accessing services. They talk about just not having time. I mean, these might in a sense be perceived as excuses, but that's something that how they present it as time to go and use services, access services. And the way that their responsibilities as a parent can mean they don't feel able to take up support. So that might be around where one of the options is for some sort of inpatient episode. And once again, I think this goes back to this whole issue around socioeconomic circumstances and deprivation. Quite a few studies saying that just parents did not see their mental health problem as their top priority, of the one thing they want to change in their lives. It wasn't that. There were other more pressing needs they felt that had to be addressed. And if it's not the most pressing concern and you're under a lot of pressure, you're unlikely to then prioritise it. And then there's sort of work which came more from sort of professional perspectives about how the mental health problem itself can be a barrier to accessing services. So obviously severity of the mental health problem, you've got how that, if it's a less severe problem, it's less likely to be picked up, less likely to be able to sort of get support or an acceptance that you need support. It might be if the mental health problem has symptoms around anger and aggression, it's very difficult to engage and work with that parent on that issue, especially if it's not your main area or way of working with a family. And the way that rapidly changing symptoms or fluctuation in mental health sort of problem symptoms can mean that might get a referral, might agree to go along to something, but then by the time you go along, you're feeling a bit better, so you don't go, and those sorts of issues as well. In terms of the way that services or organisational factors might be sort of preventing families from accessing services, I think we've already talked in terms of issues around detection and also about the way that we sort of generally collect data around parents' mental health problems, is that how different agencies have a sort of different perception of their role when they're working with a parent. So adult mental health wouldn't even necessarily perceive this adult they're working with as a parent at all. They don't see the presence of children as impacting on how they work with that adult, apart from maybe alter the way they work with the adult, but not in terms of looking at the needs, the child's potential needs for support. Social workers talk about how they feel that if they start raising mental health issues with an adult or parent, that might conflict or jeopardise the relationship they've built with that parent and with that family. So it's a reluctance to kind of jeopardise that. Child protection staff feel that adult mental health don't communicate with them, that they are looking after somebody, and there may well be child protection concerns, but adult mental health aren't communicating, aren't even aware that there might be issues. And within CAMHS, the view was that there isn't that sense that they routinely check around parental mental health issues. It's very much, again, focus on the child. Might be taking a whole family approach, much more whole family approach than CAMHS, but whether or not they are systematically and rigorously looking at whether there are parental mental health problems was raised an issue. I mean, it's inevitable, isn't it? Everyone's got their area of expertise, their job, but it's always this issue about how you kind of get that collaboration and joint working. It's quite an interesting piece of work which looked at how accurate social workers are in terms of detecting depression among the parents in their caseload. And, I mean, actually quite good. So it was a sample, I think, of 100 or so mothers, all who had a diagnosis of depression, and social workers working with those mothers, I think 66% were aware that there was a mental health problem was an issue in that case. So not bad, really, I don't think. But judgments about how acute the problem was were less kind of less good, I suppose. And then professionals, then when their judgments are often going to inform the way they then work with the family if they haven't got anything more concrete in which to base how they work. Obviously, the relationship between the parent and the professional, a lot of this is about the parent being prepared to reveal, to admit to having difficulties, and that's going to be an issue there in terms of whether or not services can respond. And I've talked about issues around skills and expertise and time, so I won't spend any more on those. And the way it's working, again, we've talked about adult mental health, not looking at parent status, not really feeling that child welfare is part of their remit, but equally not seeking to work collaboratively with agencies who might have concerns and responsibilities around child welfare of children who are children of parents with mental health problems. Even little things can stop a parent taking up an offer of service. If they phone up and their worker isn't there, that can in a sense be a reason for them to never call again. Just a little like small bits of qualitative work, but that's just such a little thing, isn't it? But it can stop a parent from continuing to engage. Issues around waiting lists, and whereas a parent might be, yeah, I'll go for it, I'll take up the offer of help, but you've got to go on a waiting list, and by the time it's their turn, that sort of motivation might have gone, that feeling of readiness to deal with it might have been lost. And the organisational factors, which I think are revealed in the fact that adult mental health don't record about parenting status. Issues certainly around eligibility criteria with an adult mental health, that the bar is set very high, and so there's going to be a lot of parents who aren't getting any sort of adult mental health support, which means a lot of undetected needs around parenting, mental health, and the needs of the child. Once families are using some sort of service, that might be adult mental health, it might be sort of family support, parenting support, there's sort of the sort of issues around how parents continue to sort of stay in those services. Again, there's things that help them stay in and things that start to become a barrier to them continuing to use these services. And obviously mental health is an issue here. So where there is depression, that's going to affect levels of motivation, ability to engage at all. Where there are issues around the child's needs as a child of a parent with mental health problems, if the mother is so, in a sense, self-preoccupied, she might not recognise that her child needs help and support, and therefore that is a barrier to the child accessing those. Obviously, with the sort of acute psychotic illnesses, professionals can actually be seen as kind of something quite threatening, and we probably all know about the issues around sort of engaging and retaining those sorts of individuals in mental health services. Really strong thing came out about the sort of usability issues. So whether it be getting along to an appointment for yourself as a parent, getting along to a parenting group for parents with mental health problems who are struggling with parenting, anything. The whole issues around getting to places, sometimes with young children as well, perhaps with young children who are disturbed in themselves, becomes an enormous barrier to parents accessing support. And it's particularly an issue in rural areas where well over half of parents say that's such a difficulty for them. Getting on, you know, a couple of bus journeys with two young children, one of whom, you know, is sufficiently kind of disturbed themselves to make it very difficult to handle them. If you're depressed as well, there's just, it's a huge mountain, isn't it, to even get out the door and get there. So that's a real issue. And around childcare, parents don't like it if their child is present in appointments, but clearly from research that sometimes happens. And obviously not having childcare is, if you haven't got childcare, that's a difficulty as well. And in adult mental health settings, sort of the lack of a sort of child-friendly area in terms of taking your child into those settings. Lots of issues around how you fit going to these sorts of, accessing this sort of support with existing schedules, demands on your parents, on your time. The fact that many families with mental health problems maybe have quite chaotic lives. They might fix an appointment for a week's time, but in the meantime, something goes wrong with their benefits and they just have to go and get that sorted out first. That becomes a priority. Crises will happen. And it's very hard to see how you kind of overcome some of these difficulties when you're asking parents to come to you as opposed to going to them. Mentioned about ethnicity and certainly sort of to question our assumptions there, but to feed that one quite strong study which showed where an Asian worker, if they can support and maintain accessing a generic support service. Some quite disturbing data from children who've been visiting parents in inpatient psychiatric settings about the difficulties there, lack of private space for family visits, inappropriateness of the setting, those sorts of issues. The therapeutic approach can be a barrier to parents continuing to engage with a service. Obviously, if the threat of inpatient admission occurs, that tends to sort of be a reason for families to withdraw. A couple of studies have shown that parents say they stopped using family therapy because they said their child wasn't liking it. Don't know what's going on there, but that might be just a reason parents are using, but it might be something they're observing in how their children respond to it. And I think this whole thing that we return to again and again about if parents feel the service isn't addressing their priorities, they're less likely to stay engaged. And if they're wanting to sort something, that their priority in their life is not the sort of priority and the approach and the focus of the service and support, that's going to affect their motivation to continue to get along. I think staff factors, obviously the parent-professional relationship, issues around trust, these aren't specific to parents' mental health problems. Honesty are going to help keep a family using a service. And parents are very sort of perceptive as to whether or not they feel the professional knows what they're doing. And that again, that if there's a feeling that they're not really, they don't trust what they're doing with them or with their child, then they tend to withdraw. So the final question Sky asked us to look at were, what are the outcomes of services or interventions which have been specifically set up for parents' mental health problems and or their families? And there's very little parent-specific research. So there's lots of evidence about effectiveness of adult mental health services. But this was about where an intervention or a service was for parents with mental health problems. And there's actually very little work. So there's 12 randomised controlled trials. And as soon as you see the word randomised controlled trial, you think, oh, that's going to be really fantastic, robust evidence. But that's actually not the case. They got this label, but they can actually not necessarily be very trustworthy. And what we've got are, there's 12 trials, very small sample sizes, all looking at different sorts of service support, so you can't even kind of collate the evidence together. And what they don't tend to do is compare a particular intervention with maybe routine care or something else. So they might find improvements because a parent's been going on to this thing, but you don't know whether what it is about this intervention that's really worked for them. So an example will be that there were two trials that looked at cognitive behaviour therapy for depressed mothers, and their outcomes were compared to mothers who'd received nothing. And the parents who'd received cognitive behavioural therapy, you know, they showed improved outcomes. Their depression had decreased compared to the parents who'd received nothing. But when you compare cognitive behavioural therapy with just going along to mums and toddler group, you get equally improved outcomes. So it's not actually been the cognitive behavioural therapy at all. It's just been something else around being supported, being listened to, that was sufficient to achieve similar level outcomes. Well, that's a really important lesson or finding to take away when you're looking at costs of services and cost effectiveness of services. So that's where it's really kind of hard to sort of you have to be really careful about the conclusions you draw from trials. And so similarly, there's another trial which looked at children of depressed parents who were given CBT. Again, it seemed that CBT had been helpful for these children. But when you look at children who got CBT plus against children who just were having their sort of normal support, it seemed no more effective in terms of improving children's outcomes compared to just that normal support. So that's just an example of how we have to be quite careful when we look at evidence from anything, but particularly around trials. Doesn't seem that where you've done sort of parenting support for parents with mental health problems, that there seems to be a particular improvement around child behaviour, which is a shame because often child behaviour is something that parents see as the cause of their mental health problems. But interventions on parenting, there is evidence that they can be improve parents' well-being. And certainly in England, they did a big evaluation of parenting support programmes like Incredible Years and Triple P. And that certainly is very strong evidence about that, the improvements in child behaviour, but also in parental well-being. So I'm not sure whether Scotland's done a similar, but this was like, you know, I think there was a sample of 5,000 parents getting one of four of those big parenting interventions. So there's very strong evidence, really, that improving parents' parenting skills, their parenting competence, has that knock-on effect in terms of their own well-being. If you look at other studies, not just randomised controlled trials, other studies, it doesn't really add any more. So really, we're looking at just 12 studies at the moment, which have really properly looked at what works in terms of supporting parents and families. Very, very disappointing evidence, I think. It just shows they're quite a hidden group, I think. I think parental mental health is a significant issue. I think it's perhaps an unrecognised issue. So with the population data suggesting a quarter of children will have a parent with a mental health problem, that's a significant group, isn't it? And certain groups of children will be at increased risk of having a parent with a mental health problem. Children in poorer families, perhaps also where there's a lone parent. There's certainly issues around detecting and identifying parents who have a mental health problems. There's certainly issues around the barriers that exist in terms of the way services are organised, the way that professional groups operate. But we do know that from the US it seems that simple screening tools applied in sort of community or generic services are effective in terms of identifying, but also helping to move along in terms of providing support to those families. I think there's an issue around we need to turn parents' perceptions of support on its head. Admitting you've got a mental health problem actually is a way of avoiding child protection processes, not the route into them. And it's really needing to sort of address that, the sort of the stigma parents have around admitting their need for support, because in a sense, if you get in early enough, it can prevent child protection processes happening. I think we need to think about how we can respond to the link we found in the population data between socioeconomic circumstances and mental health problems and what's causing what, but also from parents' views about what are their priorities in their lives, what do they feel are the causes of their mental health difficulty. Where do we intervene first? If we keep, especially if we want to keep parents engaged, it's sort of a theme throughout all the evidence. The need for greater collaboration, new relationships to be forged perhaps between adult mental health and children's services. Not be interesting to hear your views on how that is at the moment and your experiences of perhaps of trying to work with colleagues in adult mental health. And I think in a sense we need services, providing interventions, delivering anything around this whole group of adults, these parents, is we need to sort of have routine collection of data and outcomes. Has this worked? Because unless we start doing that, and we can't just do that by research, it's far too expensive, and it's quite simple, I think, to introduce routine data collection on outcomes within a service. Unless we start doing this, we're still going to have this lack of evidence base around what we should be doing for these parents. And also, our arguments, which we need to take to commissioners about what works, again, we haven't got a robust case to take. So that's really a call for looking at how your services can routinely collect data that builds a picture of whether what you're doing is working or not.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licenses, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.